Hello, it's Thursday the 22nd of April. I'm Louise Herity. This is Playback Daily and here's just some of what's coming up.
You know, the next 5 years, at the end of it, I was, you know, alone in a bedsit in Camden by myself, and, you know, there was very little real friends around me. There was acquaintances, a lot of acquaintances that I used to drink with, but the real friends had enough, I suppose.
So if you have one banana every day, fantastic, keep eating your banana every day. However, when you're counting up your 30, that can only count as one banana.
We closed first in March of last year, and then we were allowed back open in July, and then we closed again in October, then we opened again in December, and then closed at the end of December, and we've been closed since.
Well, the 93rd Academy Awards takes place on Sunday night in LA, and although we haven't been able to go to the cinema in ages, there's still a lot to look forward to. Donald Clark, film correspondent with the Irish Times, spoke to Claire Byrne to give his Oscar predictions and a look ahead to the big night.
Good morning.
The problem this year is we are watching things willy-nilly on our streaming platforms. We may not know that we've come across an Oscar contender because they're just lumped in there with everything else.
I suppose so, but at the same time, there's been as much discussion as there ever has been around the Oscars this year. But it is certainly true that, I mean, there's a whole number of things that are different this year. The ceremony itself is certainly going to be different. We're not quite entirely sure how and in what way it's going to be different. They're working quite hard to make sure that people weren't on Zoom and then, you know, nominees in various countries said, hang on a second, we can't travel. And so there may indeed be some remote stuff, as there was in the Golden Globes and the Emmys. But, excuse me, as your point about having seen the films here, yes, that will differ. It's interesting that only two of the films that we're talking about, the eight Best Picture nominees, played here in cinemas, which were Trial of Chicago 7 and Mank. And the irony there is that those two films are the two films that are on Netflix, which over the last few years film pundits have been discussing as the possible scourge of theatrical exhibition. Yet just as a kind of as an accident of timing, those are the only two that got into cinemas. Two of the films, of the eight films nominated for Best Picture, haven't got here at all yet. One being Nomadland, which, to be fair, arrives in Disney Plus this Friday. So just next Friday, I should say, sorry.
So
next
after Friday, the Oscars, just, we'll get to see that.
Yeah, 5 days after the ceremony. And The Father, which won't be here for another few months. Which, I mean, there are a number of records about to be broken here. But if Nomadland, this is Frances McDormand starring in Chloe Zhao's film about a woman adrift in an unfriendly United States, if that does win, then it'll be the, I think, I'm pretty sure, safe in saying, the first film to win Best Picture when it hasn't yet opened in the UK and Ireland since, I think, Platoon in 1987. And that despite the fact that the ceremony is the latest since 1932. I mean, it used to be a good bit later than it is normally anyway until the start of this century. But despite that, we've still had to have trouble getting the films out there because I think people were waiting to see if cinemas opened.
I heard Ryan earlier on talking about The Sound of Metal, which is on Amazon Prime, and I'm glad he mentioned it because I've been meaning to watch it since I heard the maker of that in a podcast. He sounds like a fascinating person. Do you agree, though, that that is the star here, even though it may not feature as much as maybe it deserves to in the winner's list?
I think that would be an honourable winner. Yeah, I think it is. I mean, I think there are the eight pictures are a pretty decent list of pictures. I think Sound of Metal would certainly be. I think one thing to say about Sound of Metal and also about Promising Young Woman, which people have heard a great deal about, which arrived on Sky last week,
yeah,
is that it's interesting to look and see which of the, and speculate about to what extent that we would be a different list if we hadn't had COVID, if we hadn't had a bunch of films cancelled, a bunch of films postponed to next year. And I don't think it would be that different, but I do think two films that profited from that delay are Sound of Metal and Promising Young Woman. Sound of Metal, a film about with Riz Ahmed, a terrific performance about a heavy metal drummer losing his hearing. Premiered at the Toronto Film Festival in 2019 to very good reviews, but no great Oscar buzz. I mean, the notion was this wasn't the kind of film that wins Oscars. Promising Young Woman was due to be released over a year ago in spring of 2020, which suggests that they had no great hopes of award success because you release awards films in October, that's when you release them. And both those two films sat around and went to festivals and were discussed by critics and built up a degree of momentum. So when it came round to, eventually came round to awards season, they ended up very much towards the top of the conversation. So I think those are two that wouldn't have been in the Best Picture conversation if things had gone differently and we hadn't had the COVID rearrangements.
So you're saying then that the Best Picture options here, that there's a bit of a letdown on the in the list?
No, I'm not saying that. No, I don't at all think that it's a bad list. I think there's a very, very decent list of eight films. I think Promising Young Woman and Sound of Metal deserve to be there. I'm just saying that they are not sort of they were not being positioned for award success earlier on, but by a happy accident, as far as they're concerned, if not for anybody else, it's worked out that they've ended up in the conversation.
So, I mean, it's always dangerous, isn't it, to ask you who do you think is going to win? Well, we're going to ask you anyway. We always do. So, listen, who do you think is going to win Best Picture?
I think it'll probably be Nomadland. It's won most everything else to this point. It won BAFTA, it won the Golden Globes, it won the Directors Guild of America. So I think that's probably the most likely winner of Best Picture. Though it should be said, Best Picture is the one recently that's been hardest to guess, partly because they use a proportional representation, which means it's harder to kind of pick which film will kind of like get the widest support rather than the most number ones. I mean, Moonlight and Spotlight and Parasite were all to a certain degree surprises in the last 10 years. So I wouldn't be surprised if we were surprised, put it that way.
And Best Director?
Best Director is a dead cert. Chloe Zhao, director of Nomadland, is winning that. That's one of the ones you can absolutely mark down. She's won with Directors Guild of America. She's won with BAFTA. She's won with Golden Globes. She won everywhere, which will be an interesting win for a number of reasons. She'll be the second woman ever to win, which would be good to see. The first woman of colour ever to win in that role. And also an interesting thing as well about this, about how the Oscars have changed. Should she win, she will be... that will mean that only one American-born director has won Best Director since 2010, which is an extraordinary statistic, given how rare that was. And only one of those is British, because normally when you have a director winning, he's not born in the United States, they're British. I should say Chloe Zhao is an American citizen now, so it's a slightly different situation. But that demonstrates that the Oscars have become that little bit more international over the last 10 years.
I saw some bizarre story that was reported about her where she had to defend these claims that she was a product of a very wealthy family. Did you see that? That's what was going on there. It was just something that turned into a thing online.
Sorry to interrupt. You're absolutely right. This happens every year. There is some attempt whenever to nobble the front runner, whenever it gets going. And I think she did come from a well-off background. But, I mean, the thing which annoyed me about that was that, you know, I mean, Oliver Stone came from a well-off background. His father was a Wall Street titan. He went to Yale. Tom Hooper, who directed King's Speech, he went to Westminster, I think, a public schoolboy. No one was attacking them for becoming wealthy.
Interesting. Interesting.
So I think there's a little bit of a sexist thing going on, maybe a racist thing. I don't know. But there was also an attempt to nobble Nomadland because the character played by Frances McDormand works in an Amazon warehouse at one point, and it was felt that it wasn't cruel enough towards Amazon, didn't point up Amazon's controversial employment practices. Which, again, you know, if you have a scene of 5 minutes of a woman in an Amazon warehouse, you don't have to turn it into a sociological documentary.
Film correspondent with the Irish Times, Donald Clark, on Today with Claire Byrne. And forget about the bookies' favourites. Earlier, Ryan Tubridy gave his tip for best film.
And on the subject of music and the healing power of music, I watched what I think might be my Oscar-winning movie last night, at last, because I thought that the Carey Mulligan film, which the name of which escapes me right this minute, is really good, but I didn't think it was Oscar-winning. Nomadland is very worthy and very good, but to me, not engaging quite enough to be an Oscar winner. Whereas Promising Young Woman, thanks. So the one I'm going to recommend is called The Sound of Metal. And this is a fascinating film because of what it does with sound and your hearing. And again, our friend this morning, we're going to talk to a little later on, is a drummer. So I'll talk to him briefly about this. This is about a guy. He's the coolest looking guy you can imagine. The tattoos, the bleach blonde hair. He's behind a drum kit at the beginning. and he's got his earphones in and his girlfriend is about to sing this completely crazy song, but the crowd are about to kick off. And anyway, as he's playing, you suddenly become aware of sound and the noise. And within about 10 minutes of the film, you realise something's popped, his ear's gone, and he's deaf. And he's looking around and he's going, and he's making a smoothie, and he's trying to make his coffee. He can't hear anything. They live in this kind of mobile home type situation, and he can't hear anything. And as I'm watching it, I'm going, I'm actually starting to panic because I'm feeling his fear of losing such a basic gift that's handed to you at birth, if you're lucky enough. And so he starts getting terrified. He's a cool dude, and he's really he's also a nice person, this character. And eventually he goes to a sort of a gathering with this very nice older guy who's deaf, he's not deaf himself. He was born to deaf parents, but can sign. It's ISL, all that sign, International Sign Language. And he says to him, look, you're obviously in trouble here. We can help you if you let us. And your man's going, well, I can talk, but I can't hear. Anyway, the film then goes on and talks about you get into the cochlear implant and what he hears, what you can hear if you have an implant. And it's like a bad signal on your phone. It was an insight into a world I've spoken about, but until I've seen that film, I'd never really understood it. So that's called The Sound of Metal. I watched it on Amazon Prime. It's there. It's free to watch if you have that app or whatever it's called. The lead guy is a knockout. Okay, he'd be getting the Oscar for me. The film would get the Oscar for me. His name is Riz Ahmed. I didn't know him before, but it is an extraordinary film. And I've spoken to ISL people and people who are involved in the world of ISL. We've spoken to families about it here. The Late Show has ISL on it, on the Toy Show, I should say. But it really gave an insight. So highly recommend it, is what I'm trying to say, really.
We'll take your word for it, Ryan. And you can catch coverage of the glitz and glam of the Oscars with a difference on RTE2 next Monday night at 9:35. Just when we were feeling smug about getting our five a day, the latest advice is that we all should be eating 30 different plant-based foods in 1 week to give our health a real boost. Claire Burns spoke to Louise Reynolds, dietitian with the Irish Nutrition and Dietetics Institute, to find out more.
Good morning, Claire. How are you?
This is too much for me. 30 different fruit and vegetables a week.
It sounds a lot. Now, also, we're included in there, it's plant-based foods. So you've got nuts we can include, and seeds, and whole grains, and also herbs and spices. So actually, you know, there's quite a lot in there. Now, this is a challenge that people may have seen on social media, or they may have read about it in the newspaper or whatever. And it seems to be, you know, the idea that we should be eating more fruit and veg. Now, this still doesn't, we still have the advice, Claire, of we should be eating 5 to 7 portions a day.
Okay, yeah.
Of fruit and vegetables. So if you have one banana every day, fantastic. Keep eating your banana every day. However, when you're counting up your 30, that can only count as one banana, okay? Because this is a little bit different. What this is really in terms of our gut health. And we were on chatting a couple of weeks ago about gut health. And the idea is the diversity. So there was a big study, the American Gut Health Study, which really showed that people who were eating more than 30 different plant-based foods in the week had a much more diverse range of these healthy bacteria in our gut. So we talk about the gut microbiome. People may be familiar with these terms. You know, they're very chemical sounding, but actually we are hearing more about it now. And we know that our gut health is really linked to so many other systems in our body, even overall health, well-being, our immune system. And again, in terms of your bowel, preventing lots of conditions such as constipation, and then further down the line, you know, more serious conditions such as bowel cancer.
So if people are doing this challenge, how do you do it? Do you print out a chart, stick it on the fridge?
Well, you could and actually I did, because I was going to talk to you, I said, right, we give this a go, and just to have an idea in my own family what we were eating. So, you know, I have a 12-year-old who really took this on board. And actually, it's a great way to encourage children to try different, adding different things to their diet. So just literally write a chart, you know, 1 to 30. And every time you have one of the foods, a fruit or a vegetable, or maybe a type of nut, or if you sprinkle a few seeds onto your salad, or if you put basil into your spaghetti bolognese, you write that up and add it into the list. Now, obviously, nothing can occur twice. So we started on Monday. We've already got to 22, but
that's good going.
You know, It's good going, but again, a lot of those, you know, we had onions and garlic and tomatoes and cucumber and lettuce. They're all in there now already, so
yeah,
we can't include you
those might
anymore.
You might struggle for the last day and a half or whatever you've got left.
Yeah, exactly. But also, what I'd say as well to people is don't get hung up on the number 30, because again, if you do it for 1 week and you just see how many your different fruits and vegetables and nuts and seeds that you're eating, you might find in your family you're at 10. So next week, if you get to 15, that's a win. You know, that's five more. And that's going to, it really increases the diversity of the type of bacteria that are living in our gut. And I know sometimes people might not want to think about bacteria living in our gut, but we have, you know, trillions of different microbes in our gut. And in terms of the types that are in there, no two people have the very same mix of bacteria in their gut. But what this American gut study did really highlight was that people who had a very limited diet, lots of processed food, not many different fruits and vegetables, they didn't have as healthy a gut profile.
I'm being asked here how you can include herbs and spices in this 30 different fruit and veg over the week. Seems like that's a bit of a cop-out now for putting in our herbs and spices. You'll have people
again,
putting salt on the chart and pepper.
No. Okay, no, we're not including. No, that's actually a good point, Claire. No salt is allowed. But, you know, people are familiar with things like turmeric being a spice that, you know, has been studied and has health benefits. So, again, you don't have to have, like, a big portion size of these. So when you're counting your 5 to 7 portions a day, you need to have a good size because that's giving you the benefits in terms of the amount of fiber in your diet and so on. So you have, you know, a full banana. But obviously you wouldn't have to have, you know, a full jar of spice. So it's just by including different spices and herbs. Obviously the fresh herbs are going to give you a bit more. So
yeah,
if you have a basil plant in the kitchen and you've managed to keep it alive and you throw in a few leaves, you know, that's going to give you a boost and give you a little bit more. And it's just about variety. It's really about encouraging people. You know, beans are a great one as well in here. And, you know, if you can add in even a handful of lentils into a bolognese, I think we've mentioned that idea before.
Yes, to cut down on the meat and up the plant-based.
And so, you know, you don't have to be cutting out food. We hear a lot about plant-based. And I think it's really nice to give a message to people to say, eat more of these foods rather than people cutting things out of their diet.
So if you were making a chicken curry, for example, you just cut down on the amount of chicken that you're using and boost it with maybe butternut squash,
A tin of chickpeas are brilliant to have in the store cupboards. They can be 49 cents. You know, you can throw them in. They're really easy to add bulk and loads of nutrition in there as well. Also, for example, I was in the supermarket yesterday and they have a range, 49 cents, you know, just when you walk to the fruit and vegetable section, and I saw a pineapple. And because we're doing this challenge, I said, oh, we haven't had pineapple this week. So I threw it into the basket. So again, it's just that you might start trying things that you just, because we all get very into a routine with our diet, particularly when you're busy. And if you're shopping online, particularly, you just put the same things into the basket almost every week. So this is about...
A listener wants to know, Louise, does homemade veg soup count? Of course it does, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. That would be fantastic. And again, if you're sweating off your onions, carrots, leeks, you know, you put in a potato, put anything that you add in, that's all going to count. Now, of course, then if you make the soup on a Monday and you have a bowl Monday, Tuesday and Wednesday, you can only count them all once. But that's absolutely fantastic. And the thing about homemade vegetable soup is you're keeping all of the water that the vegetables are cooked in. So you're not throwing any of the goodness away. So homemade vegetable soup is really great. Yeah.
You're not mad about smoothies, are you, in terms of their nutritional value?
Well, it's just because they tend to not be as satisfying or as filling as actually eating the fruit. Because when you drink something, it takes a while for your body to send signals back to your brain to say that you've actually eaten something and you're feeling full. So you're better off, you know, sometimes with smoothies, so much fruit can go in and it can be, you know, it makes just one glass and, you know, you drink it quite quickly. So you're still getting the nutrition. But I think, and again, smoothies are great for this challenge because you can throw in whatever extra fruits that you have. And again, things that are in the freezer, you can add in some frozen fruits and vegetables will all count in this challenge as well. So smoothies are fine. But
this listener is having fruit for breakfast, 7 different fruits every day, easy. But you see, you can only count them once.
You can only count them once.
Yeah, well, see, this is tricky.
And if you chop them up, it's great. But if she then maybe tomorrow is adding some seeds onto the top or adding in a few raisins as well as the fresh fruit. So But look, it's just, I think it's a really good challenge. And actually, I was a little bit, I thought, is there a downside to this? Because I was reading about it. And I actually rang a gut health dietitian. I asked her, so Lorraine Marr would see patients in her clinic with issues around their gut. And she said, no, it's a really good idea. And again, it just gets people thinking about diversity. So, you know, I've actually put up an article on our website as well on indi.ie so people can see the list of different foods that can be included. So things like, you know, for nuts, if you have some walnuts or a few almonds, if you want to include those in your
yeah.
diet.
But not too many of those because they're very calorific, aren't they?
Well, but a handful is absolutely fine. And they're really full of nutrition, Claire. They're absolutely packed full of nutrition.
That was Louise Reynolds, dietitian with the Irish Nutrition and Dietetics Institute on Today with Claire Byrne. With so many businesses closed for the best part of a year now, it's difficult to know what shape our economy will be in post-COVID. And on Morning Ireland, Cian McCormack spoke to people whose lives have changed because of the pandemic.
We closed first in March of last year, and then we were allowed back open in July, and then we closed again in October, then we opened again in December, and then closed the end of December, and we've been closed since.
Richard Jacob has been on and off the pandemic unemployment payment for the past year. His wife and staff have been in the same situation.
So it's myself, my wife Mairead, and four staff as well.
His business, the Idaho Cafe in Cork City, depends on a steady footfall. And that's a concern for Richard.
I think this is going to be a great summer because I think there's a huge pent-up demand from people who were working and have saved. But I'd be very concerned about the autumn. I think footfall is kind of the huge elephant in the room because the fact that there's such a move to online shopping and there's such a move to people working from home, that is going to have a huge impact on the dynamics of cities and the footfall and the way people come in.
The pandemic has been tough going for Richard, and he says it has resulted in two Irelands.
Psychologically, it's tough. There isn't a plan. I can't say, do you know, we're going to be going back on May the 17th. But I think we need to be very aware that not everyone was hurt in the same way financially. An awful lot of people had a little bit of inconvenience, or they've even done better financially because they're working from home. Whereas 400,000 people have been on a pandemic payment with no end in sight.
The predictions for the future are mixed. The central bank predicts up to 100,000 people will lose their jobs as a result of the pandemic. The ESRI says unemployment is unlikely to return to pre-pandemic levels until 2023 at the earliest. Professor Kieran McQuinn of the ESRI.
Where you will see the big bounce back clearly will be in the sectors of the economy which have been most impacted by the pandemic and by the public health restrictions. So clearly those sectors in tourism, in hospitality, retail, etc. These have all been very significantly impacted on construction up until recently. So clearly as the economy opens up, you're going to see a big bounce back in those areas. As to whether they can go back to the same level they were at prior to the pandemic, again, that goes back to the whole scarring effect and whether firms in those sectors are in a healthy enough position to really go out and employ people and hire people and have the confidence to do so.
Dr. Frank Crowley, an economist at Cork University Business School at UCC, has a different view.
On the whole, I would be a bit more optimistic than the forecasts presented in the recent ESRI and central bank reports. The economy is likely to take off like a rocket. I think we can expect a euphoria associated with getting back to pre-COVID normality, which will spill over, I think, to all sectors. You know, this would be driven by pent-up savings, new startups, just a general multiplier effects that we will get from this increase in activity. So I think we will return to pre-COVID employment levels a little sooner than that predicted by the SRI and Central Bank.
There are positives and negatives on the horizon. There's anecdotal evidence of people moving to rural areas to live and to work remotely. Again, Professor Kieran McQuinn.
Given the very high cost of housing, particularly in urban areas such as Dublin, it wouldn't be at all a surprise to see people move to non-urban areas where accommodation is substantially cheaper.
This has been experienced firsthand by Raideen O'Connor.
I moved from Dublin. We took the decision very early on. We're saving quite a lot. We were lucky that we sold our house in Dublin.
Ray Dean moved back to County Kerry to work as a manager at the Research, Development and Innovation Hub, RDI, in Killorglin in the past year.
I think the biggest change, being honest, Cian, is the childcare. You know, I was paying $2,200 a month. It's been a game changer for a lot of people. Like, I know friends from my class going to school that I would have lost touch with who moved back to the kingdom that would have worked in Google or would have worked in city councils. That's a huge game changer for the regions.
There are benefits for rural communities like Killorglin, the RDI Hub's CEO Liam Cronin.
Pre-COVID, if you decided to live in the west of Ireland or somewhere like Kerry, the assumption you had to make a career sacrifice. But that's not the case in the post-COVID world, where you'll be able to work from anywhere in any role. It definitely helps create a thriving local economy.
That was Cian McCormack's report on Morning Ireland. And because retail is closed, most of us have had to turn to online shopping to get our clothes. But it's so hard to know exactly what your rights are when it comes to buying online, whether sizes are wrong or it's not what you expected. And earlier today, Evelyn O'Rourke joined Claire Byrne to discuss the topic.
Good morning, Claire. How are you?
I'm good. Now, we mentioned jeans there at the beginning, something that I would never dare buy online, because that's something that you just need to try on, in my view. But anyway, online shopping has taken the delivery vans by storm, and you've been talking to some customers who've taken the plunge and they've a few sorry stories to tell.
A few sorry tales to tell. I've done a lot of research in my personal life for this particular report, Claire. Some of it good, and then some of it you know yourself. But yes, you recognise that those delivery vans are busier than ever. But look, the problem was, of course, for many of us, and I would have been one of them, we were cautious before COVID about clothes shopping online, but we'd no choice. And some of us are making some mistakes, which is leading to people ordering clothes by the sackful, but maybe getting the wrong sizes. And that can be really frustrating. And the first person I spoke to about this, Claire, is a woman called Suzanne Burke, who is a keen shopper, loves her fashion and her style. Suzanne has been on a kind of a weight loss mission over the last few years and has gathered thousands of followers on Instagram. Her handle is More Than Just a Mama. But she's an interesting person to talk to about this, because she does like to shop, but she's having mixed experiences with online shopping, and she finds the sizing guidance completely inconsistent. She thinks there should actually be like shoe sizes, you know, a global guide, and that would help everybody. So here's Suzanne Burke, and More Than Just a Mama, tells me more about the pile of clothes that she had in front of her when I was speaking to her, Claire, for this interview, most of which still have their tags on because she hasn't returned them.
I have a mountain of clothes, all with the tags on them, clothes that I've bought all through lockdown that just don't fit. And it's not for me putting on a bit of weight, it's the wrong sizing.
Talk to me about that, because you're a savvy shopper.
That's not to be proud of, I think. But yeah, I just find that, and a lot of my followers find the same thing. It seems to be a huge issue with the shop selling. So for example, I'm a size 14, all the tags say 14. I've bought size 14s from the same shops, but yet these are not 14s. I just don't understand how all of the shops lately seem to be just getting this wrong. So for example, like, I have a dress here in front of me, it's a size 14. I have a dress behind it, it's a size 14. There's about 2 inches in the waist in the difference, and they're both massive. Size 14. I don't understand it. It's crazy. And it kind of makes you feel when you buy these clothes and they come and you're so excited for the package coming to the door, and then you try them on and it makes you think, wow, have I put on weight? But it's not that. It is the sizing. They just don't seem to have consistency when it comes to the sizing.
And you've younger as well, and it's a problem for children as well.
Oh, it is. Yeah. I mean, there's certain websites that I can't buy from for my 3-year-old, because the sizing, it is way off. It's never the same. So I could buy something for her today in a shop and it would fit her, but I buy the same age next week and it doesn't fit. And you're like, what? Like, there's just no set guideline for sizing.
Tell me now about returning clothes, because you've got that pile in front of you. They're covered in tags. You're not returning. So you're losing money on this. It's real money, like.
Yeah, a lot of the shops do offer free returns, but then a lot of them don't. And I think it's the hassle as well, you know, especially now in, you know, in this lockdown, to go to the post office and send them back. And you just don't bother. So my wardrobe is filling up with clothes that are just not fitting me, you know, so it is a waste of money.
Finally, then, what's your advice? I mean, what have you learned through a year of shopping now online?
It's hit and miss. You know, it is the sizing. It's physically here in front of me. Like I said, dresses with 2 inches difference. I think that the shops need to stop this, and they need to have a set guideline that they follow. And they're just not doing that.
Oh, our sustainable living people who were on yesterday won't like to hear Suzanne saying that, Ev, about buying all the clothes and then the tags remain on them. But there are loads of things she can do to give them away or sell them on if she can't return them at this stage. But what she's talking about there, we all recognise that experience, don't we? Thinking you know exactly what size you are in one brand, then you go back to buy the same size somewhere else and it's a completely different fit. Is it women in particular have always had to deal with this inconsistent sizing, even before the online thing started?
Oh, I think so. I mean, that one size 14 in one brand can be so different. And we're sort of used to that. But it's frustrating when it's, I suppose, it's specific, something that you're used to. And the people that I spoke to, they're also concerned, Claire, about the knock-on effect for younger customers. And, you know, they say that pre-lockdown, they used to have to trawl through the shops and learn the hard way that a size 8 or a size 16 can mean different things in different shops. So they're a little bit concerned about the effect that that can have on younger people who are, you know, very maybe committed to a size label. So here are some more experiences shared with me from women who've just had to get used to size differences over the years, not just since online shopping came into our lives. It's always been tricky, I suppose. And as you'll hear, it's something that Suzanne is also concerned about too.
When my niece was 15, she was size 10 and went into a shop to buy a pair of jeans and had to try on anything from an 8 to a 14. She ended up walking out of the shop with a size 14, even though she was only a size 10. Luckily, she has no issues with the number on the label, so she was fine about it, but other girls, it could really knock their confidence. It doesn't hold out much hope, though, if you can't even tell your own size within the same shop.
Now, one of the things that's interesting for you is that you have a 19-year-old and you're a bit worried about the message this is sending younger girls as well.
My own daughter has bought clothes and when they come, she's a size 8 to 10 and she has the same problems. Only a few weeks ago, she bought a jeans. They were size 8. It's her size. They didn't fit. They were a mile too small. And I don't think that that's good for young girls these days. I think it sets bad thoughts into her head, you know, and I don't think it's good. And like I find myself when I buy something and it doesn't fit, I'm thinking, wow, you just feel like rubbish, you know.
So I got 2 pairs of jeans. The brand I bought them from, brand I've been buying for over the last 4 years. So they must have been made wrong or either that or they're making the sizes different again. It's just like it's really annoying. They did give me a refund back, but kind of a pain when you have to send everything back. Not sure whether I'd be buying again from them or not.
Yeah, it's a pain. It is a pain when you have to send them back. Evelyn, you spoke to a boutique owner, Laura Nolan, from Second to None in Carlow Town. Now, Laura is well used to this problem for women and she has some good advice.
Yes, Claire. She says, look, stop getting too attached to that size label. She says we lock ourselves into thinking that we're one size, but we need to be flexible. And she also made the valid point that if you buy online from a smaller local boutique like her shop, the owner there will really know their stock and the sizing and they're on hand. You know, they can help you via the phone or Facebook. So do consider having a look at your local boutique too. They're doing great work online for people, not just the major retailers. But she said, look, we're all looking forward to welcoming customers back when the restrictions are lifted. But in the meantime, she says, get your measurements. Now, Claire, it may be a bit boring and I've sighed myself trying to do this, but you should do it so that you're not wasting time and money. And Laura stocks new and nearly new designer labels, so she's used to the brand's range and that every brand fits differently. So here Laura Nolan from her lovely boutique Second to None gives me more tips and insights.
Every brand fits differently and there's so many different fits on things, from the relaxed fit to the oversized to fitted. You could be a 12 in one thing and then you could be a 16 in another thing. And they could be practically the same sizing. It's just the brands put on their own sizing and they are very, very varied. So that presents a whole minefield then.
Now, the brands are fully entitled to do what they want in terms of sizing, aren't they?
Absolutely. You need to be aware that every brand fits differently, but it's a minefield for people because when it comes to the sizing, if you're a size 12 in a certain piece, it just, you could be a 10 in one, a 14 in the other. So basically you do need to know the measurements of the clothing when you're buying online.
Are you surprised by the amount of customers who don't really know their sizes that well? Like, you can judge.
Yeah, well, that's really true. But when it comes to buying online, the one most important thing is that you do need to know your actual size. The one way of doing that is just get yourself the old fashioned measuring tape. You know, measure the widest part of your hip. If you're doing your bust, measure over, you know, maybe a top, because that's the way when you try on a piece of clothing, how it's going to fit.
Do you think we're overly concerned about the size, the number on the label?
Absolutely, yes. Yeah, a lot of people are, I suppose, they want to be maybe a certain size and they don't want to maybe admit that they're not. And you have to work around that. And regardless, they don't want to go up a size, even though they might actually need it. Yeah, so you have to deal with that, yeah.
What's your advice for people who are trying to, you know, buy more successfully online?
When you're buying online from a smaller retailer or boutique, the person that's selling the article, they're at hand to give you really good, solid information on a piece being sold. So you really have excellent customer service there. If you go then with the larger retailers, one key thing would be to check the fit notes and also to check the reviews. And that gives you a really good indication as well.
Laura Nolan there from Second to None in Carlow, ending that report from Evelyn. And now we want to focus on the thorny issue of returns, because what happens when you buy something online, it comes to your door, you realise it's the wrong size, like a texter who got a Santa suit online. I wonder, was that at Christmas or was it just this week? Anyway, he's 6'2" and the Santa suit that he got would fit a 10-year-old, and the cost of return was more than the cost of the suit. So that's why we've invited Siobhan Maguire, consumer journalist, to speak to us now, talk us through all of this, many of the other issues facing online shoppers at the moment. Good morning, Siobhan.
Good morning, Claire.
It is a bit painful, isn't it, if you have a Santa suit that it didn't cost as much as the postage to get it back. But we've all experienced the inconsistency, to go back to what Evelyn was talking about, around sizes. So you will often need to make a return.
Absolutely, yeah. The issue of standardised clothing is a long and painful saga for all of us. But in terms of buying online, your consumer rights are extremely strong, Claire. So before the pandemic, we would have been very used to buying an item in store where you would have gone in and maybe tried it on, or even picked something up, didn't try it on, but knowing you could go back in and get your refund. Now, technically, retailers weren't under any onus to do that for you. It just became kind of part and parcel of the shopping experience in store. Online is a completely different kettle of fish. We are supported by very strong EU legislation. So if you buy from any member state, you basically have 14 days, which is called a cooling off period, when the product arrives in your door and you can decide there and then, you know what, I've changed my mind. I really hate this shirt or dress. And then you have a further 14 days to send that item back. So in total, you've got 28 days to return an item, no bickering, there doesn't have to be any fault with the product, that's your right. Now, the problem that arises now for people buying online, and a lot of the ladies in Evelyn's report will probably attest to this, you get the item, it probably doesn't fit, and then you're going, gosh, you know, it seems like too much of a pain to actually have to try and send this back and pay for postage. So that's where the problem arises. So if you're buying online, you need to determine what the retailer will do if you need to post it back. For example, if I buy from Next.ie, very popular, I have to fork out the postage to send the product back that I don't want to keep. But if I buy, say, from one of the larger online retailers like ASOS, all I have to do is bag it up, stick a label on it and bring it to the nearest Parcel Connect. In my case, Claire, it's my local newsagents, which is probably why it's far too easy for me to be buying online. But it costs me nothing, okay. You know?
So we have questions coming in here, and I want to go to this one. This is a really good question. If you buy something from outside the EU, so let's imagine you're buying something from a shop in the UK, you pay the duty on it and then you return it for a different size. Do you have to pay the duty again?
You'll have to pay a certain amount. You'll cover the postage. The duty will only creep in when it's coming into the country. So this is like where you're dealing with an entirely different set of rules to those of the EU, these so-called third countries, which now, as we know, includes the UK. So buying from China or America, you're already paying your tariff duties when they arrive in. But if you send it back, it's only the postage.
But then if the item is coming back to you again in a different size, you'll have to pay again, the duties again, as it comes back in. Okay, that could be a costly exercise. A listener bought a pair of golf shoes last September. I still haven't got them, despite numerous emails. Now the emails are bouncing back. Have I any comeback or any way to get my money back?
Oh, yeah. Well, I would be trying, first of all, to get a charge back, because if you purchase online, you use a card. You charge back, it will be done through your bank or credit card.
Or and PayPal. PayPal have a good system in this regard.
Exactly. They have an excellent system, yeah. And you will get your money back quicker than if this person has been chasing up the retailer and getting nowhere. Go to whoever you paid the money out of your bank and say, look, I haven't got the product. I want to do a chargeback, and you'll probably have the money by the end of the week.
Consumer journalist Siobhan Maguire on today with Claire Byrne. And finally, Ryan Tubridy's guest was Killian Shield, a young Mayo man whose appearance on First Dates Ireland recently struck a chord with many when he opened up about his battle with alcoholism.
And what happened?
She just walked up to me and asked me if I ever thought about being a model. And to be honest with you, I didn't have the first clue about sort of modelling or fashion or anything. If my mother wasn't there, I don't think I would have went for it. She was like, you know, oh, no, these are, you know, it was Elise who are, you know, they're a big agency in London, and I'd never heard of them, but my mum had, and she was like, you're going to this, you know, so you're going to this office. So.
Okay, so now you're a drumming model.
Yeah, exactly.
At what point did that lifestyle start to become clouded by excess?
Well, my lifestyle was, if I'm being honest, was always clouded by excess. You know, even before London, I suppose I would have been, I would have been smoking lots of weed and stuff. But certainly, I would have been noticing it when I was about 25, I'd say. You know, whether it was, you know, playing gigs and all the free drink, or, you know, going out with my friends from the fashion industry to the clubs and more free drink and the after parties. And, you know, I was always more interested in, you know, it became to a point where the creative side of both jobs were, you know, sort of taking a back seat, and I was more interested in drinking and all that stuff. And then, I just really needed it, I suppose, to be social as well.
Mm. This expression about crossing a lot of lines, what does that mean?
I suppose crossing a lot of lines, I suppose drinking in the morning would be crossing a line, and being okay with it, you know what I mean? Like, not feeling guilty anymore about it, you know, and just saying, like, this is who I am now, and then, you know.
Can I stop you there?
Yeah.
Because I think somebody says to me drinking in the morning, I think, okay, we could keep going. I actually would like you to tell me, what does that mean? In other words, physically take me to the press where you take the drink out. Tell me what time it is, and tell me what's going through your mind as you reach for that drink.
Well, you're wanting the, you know, it could be 9 a.m. you know, before you go to work, you know what I mean? And you need to get rid of the anxiety, or, you know, get rid of the shakes, or, you know, you just needed to face the day. And it's really sad, but it just becomes part of life in addiction.
What are you drinking at 9 a.m. at that stage?
Whatever's in the fridge, you know, or whatever's left over, or, you know, you might have to stop on. You might have to get out of the house and go down to the shop.
And that's one of the lines that you might cross. What other lines are you talking about, Killian?
I suppose, just, you know, becoming okay with the chaos in your life. You know, I mean, you're crossing a line there. You know, your life is chaos, and you're sort of accepting it, or you think you're accepting it, but you're actually just avoiding it. You know, I for a long time, I would say, you know, in London, I'd be like, yeah, you know, I'm borderline alcoholic, and, you know, all this stuff. And, you know, in you kind of like boasting about it to kind of brush it off. And, you know, thinking that, you know, here, I'm owning up to this, but I'm, you know, nowhere near owning up to it. I'm being really immature and, you know, not facing it at all.
Did you lie?
Oh, absolutely. You know, that just becomes part of life. You know what I mean? Lying about my drinking has been something I've been doing, you know, as long as I can remember, you know, as long as I've been drinking.
Did you cheat?
Oh, absolutely, as well. You know, like, you know, if I was lying, I was cheating. You know, if I didn't have money, and, you know, I could, you know, manipulate, you know, my parents and my friends to help me out, and, you know, lie so I could get what I wanted or what I thought I needed.
Did you steal?
Yeah, there's been times where I've stolen drinks from the supermarket or, you know, in desperate times now, but yeah. I'm ashamed to say it, but yeah.
Did you at any point look around you and realise that one by one the people who had been there enjoying the crack with you started to disappear, like that photograph in Back to the Future?
Yes, that's very well put. There was a time when I was in London and I was living with my older brother and his friend and a load of my friends from university who were also session musicians. And we had the best crack. We had the best life. It was a big house. We were all best friends. And, you know, I felt like, you know, I was hard done by when they all left and moved out and all that. And I blamed them for a long time. But, you know, it was the progression. And, you know, the next 5 years at the end of it, I was, you know, alone in a bedsit in Camden by myself. And, you know, there was very little real friends around me. There was a lot of acquaintances that I used to drink with, but the real friends had enough, I suppose.
And it was the two girls in Camden you were living with I think you started to have seizures, didn't you?
Yeah, I did. That was towards the end of my drinking. Things got, you know, things were really bad.
Yeah.
And I had a seizure, and they had to find my parents on Facebook. Like, you know, they didn't really know me that well, to be honest. I still talk to one of them, and the lovely girls. Like, so yeah. They had to contact my parents, and my dad came over, and you know, he decided that was it, and he brought me back to Ireland.
And did you go into treatment at that point?
I didn't. I came back and I sort of hung around Castlebar for a while and got into a few scrapes, you know, as I was doing in London, except in a smaller town now where, you know, it becomes a lot more obvious to everyone around you. There was no kind of hiding from it then. And then I eventually went in for an assessment into Hope House with my daddy. He brought me in there, and I stayed there for a month.
It was
my first taste of recovery, or the other side of life, I suppose, is what someone said to me once as well.
Is a month the right time? I don't know. Or was that a small amount of time, or was it enough?
It's a small amount of time for it depends on the person, I suppose. For me, it wasn't enough. I went on for about 7 months, you know. I stayed sober, but I suppose I was sort of a dry drunk, so I wasn't really changing, you know, enough in my life, you know, to move on. You know, I was just kind of staying sober and not really tackling any other of the issues. So I ended up relapsing after 7 months sober. But what I realized, I suppose, when I relapsed was, you know, I couldn't drink ever again the same way as I did before I admitted I was an alcoholic. So, you know, I sort of wasn't welcome with the drinkers, and I wasn't welcome with the people in recovery. I was sort of very much on my own then. So it definitely got much worse when I relapsed after the clean time, you know.
You keep running out of road.
Yeah, that's it. That's exactly it.
When I go into the chemist, and on the rare occasion I say, can I have a packet of Nurofen Plus or whatever it might be, they always say to me, are you taking anything else? You have to be careful. You know, all this kind of, and I kind of say, yeah. And that's the end of that. But it now makes sense to me why they're so curious, or keen to keep an eye on it, because there are people out there who see Nurofen differently to the way I might see it. And you're one of them. You were one of them.
I was one of them, absolutely. So when I was back drinking and using after I relapsed, you know, I was still lying to quite a few people about being sober, you know, my family being the main ones. So I became addicted to Nurofen Plus, and because I think it was easier to hide, and, you know, it sort of has similar effects to being drunk. So I would be taking, I started off taking, you know, a packet a day, but I mean, it quickly progressed, just like, you know, alcohol or any other drugs, until I was, you know, towards the end there, my whole life was traveling around to chemists in Mayo, you know, and knocking these tablets back 12 at a time, you know, on an empty stomach to get the effects off them. I mean, the consequences are just, they're so dangerous, you know.
At your worst, how many Nurofen were you taking in a day?
Two packs of 24 would probably be the height of it, and yeah. Sometimes a little bit more. But I had a seizure because of them as well, and you know it's not to forget the poor pharmacists as well, you know, who are giving these things out. You know what I mean? Like that's a consequence people don't really think about. It's something I feel bad about anyway.
Okay. All this time, was your dad kind of covering for you? Was he keeping an eye on you? Were you wrecking his head?
I think it's safe to say I was wrecking everyone's head. But you know, he was keeping a close eye on me. But he wouldn't have been. I mean, yeah. Look, I'd do something. Something would happen because of my drinking or because of my using. And yeah, he'd give out to me and he'd be mad at me and he'd be disappointed in me. But you know, I suppose everyone would. But he knew that there was nothing he could do or not do that would make me drink or not drink. You know, he had an understanding of that. And so he was always like, you know, try again, go again, and you know, just don't give up. You know, and so was everyone, to be fair. But I think it's harder for some people to get their head around, you know, sure. Why are you doing this to yourselves? You know what I mean? It's hard to understand.
Let's get you back into treatment then for the second time. And this brings us to Navan. Is it Tabor House?
Yeah, Tabor House, yeah.
And you were there. How did that go?
So, yeah, I went into Tabor House, which is a secondary treatment centre. And, I stayed there for a month and... Unfortunately, my dad passed away while I was in there.
I'm sorry about that. Yeah, that's desperate. Because he came to see you on Easter Sunday, is that right?
That's right. He came to see me on Easter Sunday and, we had dinner in Navan. And the next day, it was Easter Monday, I think we were up in Carlingford climbing a mountain. And, I got the phone call to say he passed away, which I just couldn't accept. I mean, it was such a shock, you know, because he'd just been with me the day before. And
how old was he?
60 years old.
That's desperately young.
And that was two years ago today.
This very day?
Yeah.
Man, oh man. Gosh, what do you think he'd make of you today in the sense that you are so honest? You are so honest and you're just such a... You're like a mirror image of the pathetic creature you described only a little while ago, no family, no friends. Would you say your dad's death... did something to try and make you flip this story?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I wanted to do this for him while he was alive. You know, it was always, and for everybody in my family. But you know, the shock of losing him and knowing that I'd never get to show him like that I could do it. You know what I mean? It just made me so determined to do it. Because I do. You know, there's a part of him that's in me, and you know. That's what keeps me going, and sometimes it doesn't even feel like any effort at all because I know this. You know, he's with me, and I know what he wanted for me, and I have faith that if I do the right thing, all the things he told me that would happen would happen.
You had one last blowout, didn't you?
I went home.
After
and,
he died,
I was in a bad way for about 3 weeks, and couldn't handle it, and he definitely hit a rock bottom then, you know, they took me back in Tabor House, which was absolutely brilliant. I mean, they really didn't have to, and I'm pretty sure they broke a lot of rules letting me back in the condition I was in, but they could see that it was the last chance for me.
What it's got to be that they can only do so much, I presume. You have to do something yourself in terms of a realization, a catharsis of sorts. What was yours? What did you, when did you have it? Did you have a light bulb or a trigger moment where you said, "Nah, this has to stop now"?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'll be honest with you. The treatment center is 4 or 5 months. You know, for a reason. They usually get through to someone after a couple of months or 3 months or so, and then the last month or two is for the, you know, it's for them to take everything in. Mm-hmm. But I think when I went back in, you know, the second time, And after losing my dad and after hitting that rock bottom, you know, and with the horrendous relapse, I think I had a light bulb moment very early on because I was broken, and I was ready to listen. I was ready to, you know, thank God. Like, I mean, sometimes I just feel like it was him doing it for me, my dad, like, because I stayed there. I listened to the suggested things. And I mean, you know, I was able to put myself well aside and listen to the professionals and do all the suggested things that they said to do. And I moved to Navan. I cut off, you know, pretty much everybody apart from my family. Not because they're bad people or anything, just because I needed the time, you know, to myself to heal and to grieve and to get over this addiction and to realize that, you know, there's another side to life and, you know, start experiencing it. And the first year it was really difficult. You know, I got a job really quickly, and that's something I suppose I always thought I was a hard worker, but it was very clear that I'd never had a job in my life when I started that. So I was so lucky here in Navan, and I've learned so much in the last few years. I'm still learning.
And your mother?
Yes.
How's your mother?
My mum's great.
Is she?
She is.
You have a good brilliant relationship with her?
We have a great relationship. Now, I haven't seen her in a while. I haven't been back home to Mayo since Christmas, so I really miss her, and I'm looking forward to getting back. Hopefully, I'm 2 years sober in the 15th of May, so I'm hoping that I'll be able to get back.
You're really brilliant, Killian. That sounds patronising, but I because we talk to so many people here whose families are ruined and torn asunder by people who were like you but couldn't get through where you got through. So I hope you stay as strong as you sound to me today. I know that I saw you on First Dates, which is why you're here today. That date didn't work out, even though she seemed very lovely and you seemed like you got on very well. Did you meet anyone at all since, can I ask?
Yeah, I actually have started seeing someone in the last few weeks. So, but it's pretty new, so we'll see how it goes.
Let's not hex it by getting it go any further than that. there's a lovely message coming in. Anne O'Malley was on to say, I'm just listening to your chat this morning with Killian, a fantastic young man to have overcome so much. So impressed to hear him on your show and see him on First Dates. I know him and his family well. I've witnessed him at his worst after being such a lovely young fella. And I'm so proud of him now and so happy for his mother, Siobhan, to have the huge worry off her shoulders. Keep it up, Killian. You're an inspiration. That's from somebody listening in.
Fantastic.
Another says, I'm in tears listening. I lost my marriage. I nearly lost my kids. I put my wife and partner through hell. 2 trips to rehab and a lot more that happened. It's still happening. I lost friends in rehab from still drinking. I find it very hard at times. People are suffering. And so lovely to listen to Killian again. I was taken with him on First Dates and wish the date had gone well. He's a gentleman and an inspiration to so many young people struggling with addiction. I'm from a family deeply affected by alcohol for many years and can relate to so much of his story. He deserves every bit of happiness now. So let's leave it at that. Killian, thank you so much for your time. It's a real pleasure to talk to you, and I hope I meet you in reality at some point in the future.
No, I'd like that as well, right?
Same here. Okay, stay strong and best to the family.
Okay, thank you,
Ryan. Thanks a lot. Killian Shield joining. Bye for now.
And if you've been affected by Killian's story, you can contact the HSE Drug and Addiction Helpline on helpline@hse.ie. That's all we have time for on today's edition of Playback Daily. We're back at the same time tomorrow. So from me, Louise Herity, thanks for listening and chat to you soon.